ways to work with this at every level of our life, personally, socially,
we haven't seen each other for a little while, haven't we?
I don't need to.
On Tel Aviv,
on spiritual emergencies.
Spiritual emergencies, right. So this evening it's on life emergencies. So, must be 1 year. Or
two years ago.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I can see already my eye has just fallen on the title of a book. On books. One is called The Politics of Nonviolent Action, Methods of Nonviolent Action, and the other is A Force More Powerful, A Century of Nonviolent Conflict.
Right. So this is our basic reading material.
Well, so, if you'd like to begin and share a little bit about your perceptions and your concerns and areas of attention that you and I and others need to give to, I obviously will also come in from time to time. And of course, thank you very, very much for making the time to come this evening. We're very, very appreciative. Ran, how much time do we? Oh, it's a good man. How much time do we have?
1 hour.
1 hour. All right. Is this 1 hour Swiss time or Israeli? English.
Indian.
A little worried. All right.
Thank you.
If you could say a little bit with your good name and a little bit about yourself, so as to lead us in.
Alright, my name is Nachi Aron. I'm not a teacher, as Aron said. I'm a student, like all of us. I do teach Buddhist psychology with Yaakov Raz, a professor.
Yes, Yaakov.
Yeah. I'm a clinical psychologist, and one reason I chose the topic of nonviolent struggle is that my colleague, Professor Chaim Omer Meset, wrote a book recently, The Hasatan Shel Enenu, that deals, among other things, with non-violent struggles or how to manage conflicts when the conflict is inevitable. And I'd like to talk a little about that, because in spiritual training we think mostly in terms of conflict prevention or conflict resolution, but we do not deal much with the question, what happens when dialogue breaks down, when there is no dialogue, what then? What then has a clinical spiritually inclined person to do? Or to that matter, how could everybody manage conflicts in a way which will be less destructive and more constructive? And I would like to talk maybe 15 minutes about Chaim and myself and my perception, and then we can discuss it. There's a strong element of the Buddhist thinking behind our thoughts. Chaim has been studying Gandhi for a long time. Chaim is not Buddhist. I am a Buddhist of the Tibetan tradition. So you can trace Buddhist thought and Buddhist psychology in what I say. But let us begin with the following. Our perception is that we can, in conflict, we can be either in dialogue or in open battle or struggle. There are two alternatives, dialogue or struggle. And this is wrong. This is wrong perception, because when dialogue breaks down, we can still work in struggle in a constructive manner, because we could think of struggle as we could think of struggles as having two great options. One option is a destructive struggle. When I feel that it is a life and death business, and my main obligation is to win the opponent, the enemy, and I have to win him or her regardless of prices and outcomes, because if I do not beat him or her, then I will beat him. And then all harms are necessary prices, including harms to third parties. If I think along these lines, then my main aim would be to harm the other as much as possible, and let Mabul Akhari, after a while,
disregarding
outcomes. And we all get into that. We can see when people go into divorce court matters, people can do extremely harmful things even to their own children. Even people who are very good parents, very caring parents, because they feel they have no way but to destroy the other. We have this in the political sphere. We are all immersed in a life and death conflict in which both sides inflict tremendous harms on the other, regardless of outcomes, because the feeling is that it is either him or it is either them or us. Usually, the them are the demons. We demonize the others. So we get enmeshed into this kind of destructive struggles, which have short-range negative outcomes because the level of destruction is enormous, also have long-range outcomes because they destroy every possibility of dialogue in the future. So all the positive elements of the relationship are destroyed. On the other hand, we can lead very effective constructive struggles when our obligation is not to win but to resist. When we aspire to inflict the least damage possible, when we aspire to maintain the positive aspects of the relationship to the future, then we lead or we manage the conflict in a totally different manner. And we can be very effective and yet decrease the level of harms to a minimal degree. And we see that in many ways. The most well-known stories are Gandhi's struggle in India in the 30s, but we have many, many political examples of that, and we have life situations in Israel. For example, if we think of what we all experienced recently in the disengagement. The disengagement process from Gaza Strip was an unbelievable non-violent struggle, which very extraordinarily was led simultaneously by both sides without the dialogue. It's a rare example in history. Actually, there is no precedent in history for a non-violent struggle made by two sides which are opposing each other. Each has his own strategy, no dialogue about the essence of the conflict, and yet no one bullet shot, wounded people, and there was an outcome, and there was maintenance of the relationship with very little price as compared to what could have been had it been violent. So there is this option, there is this alternative of being very firm, we can be very firm, we can be very emphatic, we can strive to get an outcome. We don't have to have a dialogue, at least temporarily, with our side, and still we can think of the long-range outcomes, and we can do it very decisively, very sensitively, and the price, short-range and long-range, of this kind of struggle is 100 times less than the price of violent struggle. Now, what kind of thinking enables us to run a constructive struggle or a non-violent struggle? And I will briefly speak of some basic assumptions that are typical to the destructive struggle as opposed to basic assumptions in a constructive struggle. First, the obligation in destructive struggle is to win. Win, it's my conquest is your destruction. It's an either or situation. I have to win at any price. This is a destructive assumption. The contrary assumption of the constructive struggle is my obligation is to resist to what you do. I have to do my best to achieve my goals, but my obligation is not to win, is to resist. The basic difference between these two. Second assumption of the destructive kind is that I and my opponent are totally different. We are the good ones, they are the bad ones. There's a Tzira Resha. It's the sons of light against sons of darkness. I am rational. He only understands force. This kind of making a distinction between myself and the other, seeing the other as basically evil or basically having negative intentions, is a major state of mind of the destructive. Because we are so different, there is no chance and no reason to try to converse. Compromise means indirect surrender because the other is evil. He is only planning or conspiring to destroy us. On the contrary, on the other side, in constructive struggle, the other is no different than me. He or she or them have their own aspirations, their own views, but their thinking is not different from me, and they are not monolithic, one block. They are of different skins, they are different voices, they are the moderates and they are the extremists, and we can have some kind of dialogue with at least a part of this other group. So the basic similarity and the multi-voicedness is my assumption when I am going to lead a constructive fight. Now, in the destructive fight, I work by the principle of retaliation, an immediate one. I have to retaliate to the same measure that I was taken. I was dealt with the opponent. If I do not respond immediately to the same degree of destructiveness, then I am on the losing side. So I have to retaliate. And we know the psychology very well from everyday newspaper reading. We have to retaliate now and immediately with full force. It's not even an eye for an eye, but two eyes for an eye. Otherwise, I'm lost. And every move of mine in which I didn't retaliate makes me vulnerable to the next attack by my evil opponent. In the constructive side, I do not have to retaliate, I do not have to respond at all. In fact, I choose to use asymmetry of means. I do not, it's advisable not to use the same kind of means that my opponent uses. So I kind of always says, Hakeala Basel Bordoka, or hit the iron when it's cold rather than hot, because I do not have to respond as my opponent does. And if we think of Gandhi's struggle, for example, it means, you remember the salt tax march, it's a totally different in kind from the kind of means the British use. An asymmetry of means means that I initiate, I choose the time and place and means, and I do not have to respond symmetrically. Asymmetry makes it a profound difference as opposed to the symmetry of attack and counter. Now, the destructive struggle is based on suspicion and resentment. It's a suspicious atmosphere and it calls for secrecy. I have to conspire against the opponents, otherwise he will conspire against me, so I have to keep secret. The basic approach of the constructive struggle is transparency, openness, public. So very often, non-violent organizations run very decisive struggles with full openness, including inviting the opponents to listen to what is taking place. So transparency has many advantages. One of them is that when the leadership is blocked, there is another leadership evolving. But transparency and openness, as opposed to secrecy and suspicion, is a very important assumption. And last word is that if we look at these principles, the disengagement took part according to these assumptions, the constructed assumption. In fact, Chaim and myself, as a council, Chaim counseled the military, army and police, I to some degree went to the settlers, and they all accepted the same reasoning of constructive struggle because it's so common sense. It's no big deal, it's not profound Buddhist thought, it's just common sense. So they adopted the same principles, and there are many examples in history in which similar lines were taken. The most recent one is in Georgia and Ukraine a few months ago, in which dictatorships were toppled down by sheer force of constructive fact. I finish.
Thank you. Yeah. An important reflection there. Whatever, can you hear okay? So, I'd just like to respond for 2 or 3 minutes. And then, if you and I explore this rather key theme of struggle. And I'd just like to look at it initially from the personal and inner level and see its manifestations in the outer. During the time, for those of you who've just come this evening, during the time that we're here, each day we have some groups. And the theme of the group that I had today was love despite difficulties. And when the group and I were sharing and exploring together, one of the things that we looked at and noticed collectively, I would say, is what's going on inside of us has its manifestation personally, socially, and politically. It's somewhat of the same story. Outwardly, there is a perception about something. And this, whatever it might be, gives rise inside of ourselves to some anger, aggression. And as you pointed out, that the view is he, she, or they are different from me. And then only in the perception of other as differences can violence take place. Only in that perception. It depends totally on the other. But if we dig a little bit deeper into ourselves, whether it's at home or on our streets or in the office or in the club or in the group or whatever, we see that somewhere under this aggression and this wish to hurt, this determination to get revenge, or whatever the driving force is, there's going to be some fear. There has to be. Indispensable. And this fear is of being hurt, losing what one has, and therefore one's going to inflict the pain on the other. Withdrawal of love, cutting off of access, we're talking about the course here for a moment. And we look a little bit deeper into ourselves, into the fear that's going on with ourselves. And the spark out of that is we feel hurt. Somebody has hurt us. And we have a great problem as men and women of the earth of dealing with feelings of being hurt. On 9/11, I was on a flight over US airspace, and the pilot said to us, as to many others, that no aircraft is allowed to land in US airspace. That we would have to return back from the country of origin. 58 planes every day leave London Heathrow Airport for the US. You can imagine the chaos that was there. And when there and coming back, and then going back to the States, and I go regularly there a few weeks ago, and visiting Ground Zero, etc. One of the things that become very apparent to me, working with American citizens, is that the feeling of being hurt, the national psyche being wounded by the attack of Al-Qaeda, brought about the desire for revenge. We have been hurt, we can't accept this, we can't tolerate this, therefore we have to do the same. And it's not unusual, of course, that the method is rather similar. Planes bombing Afghanistan and now, of course, into Iraq. So there's a process which goes on in our personal lives, which is then reflected in our political lives, which is starting off with the feelings of being hurt, feeling wounded, and we can't deal with it. So in our reaction against it, we want to move away from that feeling. And the method that we do it is to feel afraid, it builds up a pressure, and in that pressure we build up and we have to point the accusing finger. And in this case of the administration, they didn't know who it was, so they picked on Afghanistan. And this sequence that keeps replaying itself and again through history gathers with it thought. And the thought which is going on appears to be detached, as though it's objective. It comes across sometimes in the courts or amongst our politicians as rational thinking, as clear objective thinking. It's bullshit. It is coming out of the emotion. It is coming out of I or we feel hurt with whom we have identified ourselves, and it looks very rational. But it's not. Rationality is the escape from the emotion and from the feeling. And this sequence, amongst men and women of the earth, keeps displaying itself again and again and again. And one of the things which I mentioned at the other level, there's been some meetings where in Britain we've been trying for some years now to set up a ministry for peace. And a parallel has been trying to set up in the United States called the Department for Peace. And I don't know how well you know the history of these things. But the English, and therefore we can excuse the Scots and the Welsh, have been engaged in more wars on this earth than any other nation on the earth. Since the year 900 AD, it's been approximately 56 years out of every 100 the English have been at war. So hiding behind the veneer of being civilized is remarkably uncivilized. And it's reflected, of course, in recent situations. And at a meeting in Parliament, I met with the leader of the House of Lords, and she said to me, "Christopher, do you know who the most angry people are that we have to deal with who come with a petition, who come to change? Are peace activists." She said they are unbelievably angry and come in with their self-righteous arrogance, think that they know, and putting and rubbishing us. And what happens when we're angry? What happens when we're so identified with our ideology, called a peace ideology, I don't care what it is. We also have to project what? The same story. We project the blame onto others. I don't know how it is for you when you feel blame. I know what I feel when I feel blame. Either I my mind might want to go to some source and say, "Well, what about me? What about you?" Saying that. Or one just feels it's too much, and one just doesn't want to listen to people who are aggressive, negative, angry, fault finding and putting down. So one withdraws. And this movement of feeling hurt, being identified with the cause, fear that it will continue the problem, getting angry with others, puts the peace movement in the same problem as the very people that one is trying to give a peaceful message to. We have a word for it in English. It's called hypocrisy. So the responsibility of us is to be able to look deep inside. One. But just to do that would never be enough, no matter how well you and I might know ourselves. But somehow or other, we've got to look at, we'll touch upon it in a moment or two, this whole area of what struggle is. And I know as a person who travels a lot and has the privilege of traveling, that in just going, I mentioned I think yesterday evening, to Nablus regularly, and just listening to the stories. And in 12 years of coming here to Israel, in having delight, and I just love coming here and have very deep and close friendships with many, many people, but rather sadly, and it's not your fault, it's the fault of your leaders, there isn't permission, there isn't the opportunity to go and feel and see and know through your own experience what life is like on the other side of the obscene wall which has been built in other people's land in your name. I mean, I was just in Nablus just a few days ago. I just give you one, it's a small incident in going through the checkpoint. Just kind of encapsulates what we're talking about here. Young woman, she's younger than my daughter, she's 22 years of age, very beautiful, with the long grey tone and the scarf there. Arrived at the checkpoint, and the soldier at the checkpoint demanded from her mobile phone number and kept putting up pressure on her for it. And she naturally enough had no wish to give it to him. And she says, what do you want this mobile phone number for? And then he said, because then I can ring you up every night. Can you imagine, long line, Palestinians, men and women, and it was 7:30 in the morning. This is one small incident. And it continued through the day. Her brother came to the checkpoint 2 hours later. He was threatened with arrest. She was being bullied. She was told that everybody from her village, just outside Nablus, would get into trouble unless she gave him the number. She said to him, I want to speak to your officer. He said, I am the officer. And this continued to 4:30 in the afternoon. And she just, to her credit and her strength and her integrity and her dignity, this young woman would not budge. She would not take a step back. She would not give the mobile phone over. She stood her ground. I think it's a noble person that can do that when she's been yelled at and abused at and threats are being made to her. It's the same story. It's the same story. Here is the struggle taking place. And I said to her, in the communication and sharing with her, these things can have an impression. And I said to her, how was it for you afterwards? Because sometimes you and I can stand up to the rage of another person, the aggression, the anger, the shit that's being thrown at us for some reason or other. How are we going to handle this? And if it touches that place inside of feeling really hurt and really wounded, and it's not going back, and we just sit on it, it gets inside of us, this anger will have to go somewhere. It will have to go somewhere. The soldiers come back here, and their aggression and their unresolved issues get thrown at their loved ones, their family, their home, etc., etc. Ask any army psychologist. It's a nightmare. When the Palestinians go home, and the Palestinian women especially were talking to me more so than all my previous visits, she said, Christopher, please understand what's going on in our homes. The men have no work, the brothers, the sons have no work. There's incredible pressure in our homes. The soldiers are coming, we never know, at any time, more than 200 arrests in the last few weeks. What is going on for these poor people in the aggression and the pressure that builds up for them, all in our name? And somehow or other, we've got to feel some connection. We've got to dig deeper into ourselves and get out of this being English or being Israeli or being Arab or being Jew or being Muslim or whatever. These ideologies wrapped up in the name of the nation state do not serve our interests. We have to hold it lightly. So that somehow or other we can connect and feel. And that may still, as you were saying, may still include some struggle. But, as you so importantly pointed out, it's not I am right and you are wrong. I am going to conquer you. I am going to rule over you. I am going to dominate you. And what I am going to make you suffer. I am going to humiliate you. I am going to make you feel bad like I feel bad. And I think every day in your life and my life, you and I, we've got to catch ourselves with this. We've got to catch this anger and this violence inside of us. We've got to catch this, the fears inside of us, and the feeling hurt and not being able to deal with it. We've got to appeal to something deeper. And most of all, we've got to connect with people who are much less fortunate than ourselves. Something has got to shift. And I don't think this is just political. This is something spiritual about it. This is something about human awareness and sentient life, saying, look, we're all in this life together. And the word, whatever it is, Palestinian, Israeli, whatever, is just a word. Never could be anything more nor anything less. Then that brings in something spiritual and political and bring together. And I hope my dear peace activist friend do a little bit of soul searching on this one. You know, too many of us have been in demos and hearing people shouting and yelling and abusing. It's not the answer. All right, I had a rave there. All right. Okay. So
thank you for moving that. I accept every word, of course. I want to respond, not to contradict you, but to compliment.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Compliment.
Yes. Gotcha.
Also compliment. I fully agree with that. Without a change of heart, without a change of mind, very little can be done. However, at times, change of heart is not enough, especially among those who are not the decision makers. Because the decision makers who have some power are the people who least of all would bother to deal with their anger or stress. And there are elements in this struggle, including the war, the world, there are elements of power as well as spiritual elements.
Yes.
And power has to be taken. Mm-hmm. Because if we only act to change our minds, this will not suffice.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel, and I think that if I take the situation you're speaking about, I feel that the peace movements, me included, has not done enough, not only on spiritual level, but also on the practical level.
Yeah.
One thing is that we may have personal pain, we have rage, we have criticism of government. We, I think, never translated it into an effective action.
Yeah.
And you see, because and one thing is very apparent that protest by itself does not yield fruit. Protest activities, when they recur, produce less and yet less impact. And the main expertise of the peace activists here is protest. Very noble, I took part in that. It is not effective. And our understanding has to be translated into action, and action has to take place on the political level, on the legal level, aiming at the sources of force of those who create the force, for example. And we, there is an aspect of power that has to be tackled, because otherwise we'll end up in endless demonstrations, which are good mostly for us to feel better. But we have to fight, and to fight, there are all kinds of things, and I can share some of my thoughts about how to conduct an active struggle. Now, one thing is apparent, even for us, feeling helpless doesn't lead us anywhere. We can feel profound pain of the situation in others, and I do, and all of us do. Feeling helpless, in fact, of what is taking place is lethal for all of us. So we have to develop some sense of potency, and potency emerges out of action.
Yeah.
So if we can translate our state of mind to action, not protest action, but effective action, mm-hmm. then we feel a little less helpless. If we see something we are doing is working, mm-hmm. then we can go on further. For example, there is now, may I take two more minutes?
Sure.
There is now, a new project of demonstrating in Israeli settlements. You may have seen that demonstration in Hebron tonight and tomorrow in some other settlements. My feeling is that unless the power of settlements is tackled, mm-hmm. no use. So it's not really noble self-sacrifice, mm-hmm. no use. And the power of settlements mm-hmm. draws from many things, from the way bureaucrats support and the way electricity company supports settlements and the way water is shared. Mm-hmm. And unless we tackle problems of water and electricity and all that, our demonstration will lead to nothing. Now, if, for example, we succeed in making, in doing something about the illegal settlements mm-hmm. effectively by tackling the sources of power of this, yeah. then we all feel a little more effective mm-hmm. and then we can look better, because the worst situation to look inside is when we are helpless and when we are frustrated.
Yeah.
Then we can only help guilt, mm-hmm. and guilt is not very effective. So we have to be effective. When we get effective, we can look mm-hmm. in a better manner inside, and then we can spread this better. So the question of effectiveness is very important.
Okay, so let's have some questions flow in. Yes, that's the back, because you've been waiting for some time.
Okay. I wrote a book, The Magical Genius of Light, and it was translated to Arab.
Yeah.
I met the Prime Minister, Ariel Sharon, even though I didn't vote for him. He knew that I didn't go for him, and it was a very powerful experience for me. It was 2 years ago, and we talked about Mandela and the power of one person to change history. And then this, because it is to you, Christopher, that I want to talk now.
Mm-hmm.
I said, when you talk about the soldier and the women, I didn't feel that you had mm-hmm. this compassion to the ignorance of the soldier or whatever, ignorance, mm-hmm. not in a judgmental way. What I felt in my body, in my physical, you know, mm-hmm. when you talk, my energy,
yeah.
said that he's talking about not putting people into boxes, but he's doing the same. I couldn't feel the compassion, and that, you know, made me feel very curious, because I felt that you were talking about the radical left. Witness that they are very, you know, they're coming from fear and judgmental, and but I felt that you did the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Can
it's
I?
Not very honest, so I really, and, you know, I feel that there's something that is not synchronicity. I couldn't feel compassion for the soldier. It's like you're talking about compassion, universal compassion, but you're putting him in the boxes, the good and the bad.
I'm not a Buddhist, I don't have to feel it.
What?
I'm not a Buddhist. I don't have to feel universal compassion. So let me respond to this. In the situation that I referred to, I was bringing you a report from a young woman who was having to stand there and face up to many hours of abuse. Systematic abuse, and I stand by what I say. To stand there and take that is not easy to take. I asked her afterwards, what was the effect? I asked her certain important basic things. Could she sleep? Could she talk about it? Could she eat? Could she go back to the checkpoint? She said she went back to the checkpoint 2 or 3 times, but then she couldn't go back because the soldier was shouting out to her in kind of personal, friendly names, and this frightened her. I had no anger towards the soldier, I had no blame towards the soldier, I had no negativity towards the soldier, and I'm certainly not afraid of anybody on the earth. I'm just bringing you a report. But what you feel is what you feel. And I just have to say, why did you get so angry? What was going on? Because it's a little bit of what we were discussing. Somebody said something, you feel hurt, you feel it in the body, anger comes, or some tension, and I just wondered, is it a little bit of the dynamic? I didn't feel that in myself, towards the pass through those checkpoints, you know. But I just wondered, is it a little bit of the shared dynamic here? And do you and I, in terms of have to get into any struggle with each other on this?
Do you want me to do introspection now? And
yes.
It seems that what bothered me was this feeling that we were talking about really having, and you know, compassion, we're all human beings, that's what Matthew was talking about in you. I mean, compassion for the ignorant, for being trapped in this dimension of winning and losing. And then I felt, okay? No compassion for the soldier, because he's also living by givers or whatever. Mm. And you know, he's also been doing that, and he's also having his nightmares and been putting this, horrible. Something that I felt, actually also with my history, my personal history, if you want. But when I feel that what we are talking and what we are. It's not.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yes, please. Yes,
please.
You have to respond.
No, I think that compassion doesn't mean that I must have the same attitude to all people involved in the situation. Definitely a very asymmetrical situation in which one is abused and the other is abuser. I can have compassion for what makes a person to abuse others, but still it is asymmetrical, and I can feel a profound resentment towards behavior. I can, even though I can understand some of the situation that leads this person to abuse, it's not symmetrical. And there is a victim and there is an abuser, it's not symmetrical. So, and even the compassion is different. And I think this is my feeling.
First of all, thank you for doing whoever decided to set this up. I think it's a very important setting and it's a good container for all of us. I think that there's a lot of things going on now, and there's many different people that have taken into consideration that being an angry peace activist doesn't work, and many, especially the young people, 18 to 23, that are using different methods of speech and language to be able to connect to soldiers, to be able to refuse, even sometimes head-on in front of guns, in front of tear gas. And they use these methods of compassion, and they'll tell the soldiers, we are not against you, we are for you, we're here for you. One of the things that I think that we forget is that the experience itself, the fact that we can't go over those walls, the fact that we are separated by our leadership is the greatest violence to us. It's a physical state of violence. We live in a state of violence. And that separation is painful for us in our minds and outside. And there's two things that I want to say about that. I think that resisting, crossing those borders against the law that we don't accept, that is one way that we can resist in a nonviolent way, although it has very high prices for us. And the second thing is that there's a dichotomy between the spiritual people and the activists. I am part of both communities. Every time I have to wear other things, I have to wear hats, my all kinds of things. That look at your gear, happy there. You know, it's kind of difficult. But I think that it's the only thing that can help us is that coagulation of the two communities. And I can hear what you both are saying. And if we can even take this container and see how. We start making these communities talk, even very gently, in very simple ways, without getting people to do anything that they don't want, but just getting them to do, because there's so many things to do and so many initiatives and so many amazing people that are going way beyond, that I think that's the most liberating experience. And why don't we take this opportunity to see how we can start placing people where they can liberate themselves inside and liberate themselves outside.
Yes, sir.
First of all, thank you for coming. And
thank you.
I look inside before I speak to see what is motivating me.
Yeah.
And I notice that I have a lot of anger inside. And that anger comes from a lot of pain.
Yes.
The pain of what has been going on here since the time that I became aware and took it into myself. Came out of my bubble. And my objection is was to the way you phrased what you said in a very certain way, showing a very certain picture. But what we keep forgetting is that the pain is on both sides. And and I'm the first one, I hate that word that we're talking about. I think very mechanical, technical thing to do, like quick solution. On the other hand, you suggested to go to Nablus, but when the last intifada started, and people that were still friendly with people from the Palestinian territories went there, they did not come out of there. They did not come out of the territories. And now since the wall is built, there are less bombings in the country. Now, I'm not arguing that the wall should be there, and I'm not arguing that the Palestinians, and if I was there and if I had heard that soldier do that, I would have really, really gone crazy inside. I don't know how I would have reacted outside. I'd probably file a complaint against what he did was terrible. But you have to remember all the facts. You cannot say, especially when you speak to a big public, we cannot say, this is the picture. It really, really, it's so complex. So complex, and it's really to do with people's psychology and history and a lot of things. I think that personally, the best thing is to just create, get to know the people, each other, meet Arabs and Israelis and Jewish and etc. Thank you for letting me.
It is true. In talking just a few minutes ago and now, I have the privilege. I can go and listen. I can go and talk with the Palestinians. You don't have it. I have it on this level, at this present time. I think I'm the only one in the room that can go. And
you're wrong.
No.
It's your permission.
Hands up, how many people have been to Nablus in the last 2 or 3 months? And I don't want to labour the point on this, but more, I think, just more important, I want to reiterate 2 or 3 things. One is, whoever we are, need to do some pretty deep reflection and introspection in the spiritual community and in the secular community. We need to be much more creative, as we were listening to a few moments ago, with our imagination. Demonstrations are fine, walks are fine, petitions are fine, letters to our members of parliament are fine. But there also has to be a whole wide range of other initiatives, because the duty, the profound duty of citizens of this earth is to recognize the interdependence of all people. This is far more significant than the personal wishes of the nation state, whichever the nation state. And the peace of others is our peace. And somehow or other, We have to look at that. We have to look, as we were listening to a few moments ago, the ideologies which are suppresses. Democracy, frankly, is dying. Dying. In Britain, as an example, in the last general election, of those people who could vote, 20% voted for the current Labour government. If everybody in Britain who voted, and it was the same number of the two primary parties, Labour and Conservative, the Labour government would have a majority of 100 seats. So all voted the same. So to imagine here and elsewhere that there is true democracy taking place is a mythology. The second ideology that you and I live under day in and day out, which certainly has to be questioned, is corporate ownership of resources. Gas, water, air, electricity, land, etc. And how people, you and I, are converted, and I mean it, converted as ideologues into consumerism. That freedom, for us, is the freedom to have and to become, to own and possess. And these ideologies hang over each and every one of us. It's called the system. And we, in our arrogance in the West, wish to impose this on others. Who the hell do we think we are? And it's going to need creative imagination, the love and compassion and exploration. We have to take risks, and that will mean, as been said several times already, it's going to mean some struggle. And it's going to mean, this is never comfortable for the spiritual ones, it's going to mean criticism. Criticism of the nation state, criticism of the military, criticism of the politicians, and not to be afraid to criticize.
It can cost personal cost.
Of course.
If you oppose, then you can be oppressed, or it can be...
Of course. And it's through small groups of people like you and I meeting together, talking together, saying, what can we do? What steps can we make? And we mustn't be afraid to speak up. And we mustn't be afraid to be misunderstood and make mistakes. If we're going to be so cautious and careful, whether those of us in the privilege of sitting up here or you sitting in your various positions of authority, we're just going to go, oh my God, I said the wrong thing. Oh, I've upset somebody. Who the hell wants to live like that? Yes, I know that.
I want to thank both of you for bringing together two points of view that I think that they can be mixed in a very good way. And we had the same conversation this morning when you told me the same story this morning, and I was just thinking about it. And I think that the U.S. and International has a very important role. You did one step in the role by bringing the story. But I think that I want to suggest you have another role. And I think that this is important role.